UK Wine Show, show number 116. Mariella Minari from Catina Zepta. On this week's show, we're talking to Mariella Minari on the effects of altitude and grapes and wine. We're going to be talking to her about what happens to the grapes and the wine as you increase the altitude.
And in the news, drinks industry fails to self-regulate and drinkers set world record for wine tasting.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 116 for the 1st of August 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Mariella Minari from Argentinian producer Catina Zepeda. We're going to be talking with Mariella about growing grapes altitude and what is the effect of UV light on those grapes. This is part of a two-part look at UV light and wine, and next week we're going to be talking with Tim Finn from New Zealand Nelson producer Nordoff about some of his experimentations with UV light. Now, I had an email from a listener who thought my introduction to Jane and the news was a bit formal. So next up, we have the news with Jane.
Very good, Chris. Well, first up this week, research by the accounting firm KPMG has shown the drinks industry is not following its own code of conduct and has found evidence of poor practice in the way alcohol is promoted. KPMG was appointed by the UK government to undertake a review of the effectiveness of the alcoholic drink industry's social responsibility standards in contributing to a reduction in alcohol harm in England. This was done through observational studies over a 5-day period in 8 locations across England and visiting nearly 600 premises, including shops, pubs and clubs. It found that voluntary agreements, which were launched in November 2005 and signed by 16 trade associations, are not being followed. Evidence of this included inducements of people to drink more and drink faster, allowing underage drinkers entry to restricted premises, and blatantly serving intoxicated people. KPMG say that in the current trading climate, the commercial pressures were overriding adherence to these voluntary measures. And last week, as a result of the review, the government's announced that mandatory regulation and labelling could be on the cards as part of a new set of standards for the industry.
Well, it looks like regulation is on the way. The problem with all these reports is in the terms of reference. For example, in the report there was a section on alcohol units not being labelled on bottles. They went in and surveyed a number of different beverages that showed units and those that did not. Sounds fairly sensible. And not surprisingly, quite a few of the bottles didn't show units on them. However, many of these products would sell in very low volumes, and all the products that were sold in high volume did have the units counted on them. Based on the volume and what people actually drink, the units are well displayed. But if you buy an obscure Cyprus wine that comes in by 3 cases at a time, you're not necessarily expecting to get UK units on them. Personally, I have no problems with mandatory labelling in theory, but it will disadvantage smaller producers, which will result in less interesting wines coming into the UK, as producing labels specifically for the UK market may not be worthwhile. But from cracking down on wine to cranking up, what's Wetherspoon's been up to, Jane?
Well, the pub chain Wetherspoon has broken the record for the world's largest wine tasting. Guinness World Records officially confirmed last week that a new record has been created by 17,450 people who tasted wine simultaneously in Wetherspoon pubs across the UK. For the record-breaking attempt, Wetherspoon encouraged drinkers to participate by offering them a free glass of Fetzer Coldwater Creek. The previous world record was 5,100 people, which was set in Spain in 2006.
Well, knowing Wetherspoons, it was probably more about drinking wine than tasting it, but good on them. What's next, Jane?
Well, finally this week, there's some news of our own. For Australians who can't tell their Sauvignon from their Semillon, soon will, because 3050 has launched in Australia to offer wine tastings at home and at work. A team of wine consultants in Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne and Perth is ready and waiting to unleash the 3050 wine tasting experience on the Aussies, with tastings themed around Australian wines, Australia versus the rest of the world, and international wines. So if you're listening and you're in Australia, do check out our website, www.3050.com.au. That's all from me this week. Don't forget, you can get more updates on these stories at our website 3050.co.uk. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. As Jane said, we've got a great team in pretty much all the main centres of Australia now running our wine tastings. If you live in the UK and you want to recommend us to a friend and they run a tasting with us, we're quite happy to send you a bottle of champagne. So if you've got some mates back in Australia who you think might be interested in a wine tasting, do recommend them to us. Tell them to give them us your name and we'll send you a bottle of fizz. Next up, we have the Spotlight. With the Spotlight on Wine and Health over, although I do hope to come back and do some more interviews on this later on in the year, I thought we might look at English wine in the Spotlight for the next couple of weeks. So, Spotlight on English wine. The English weather may be the butt of international jokes, but the island's climate warmed by the Gulf Stream means that England can grow vines successfully at a latitude over 50 degrees, the normal limit for winemaking. But it can be difficult to ripen grapes this far from the equator, which is why vineyards are concentrated in the warmest southern counties of Kent and Sussex, and only relatively early ripening varieties are suitable. This is slowly changing as wineries spring up further north. In York, for example, in 2005, there was only one winery. But by 2006, three new wineries had sprung up. In the past, the climate was once considered the Achilles heel of English grape growing, and is currently 1 degree Celsius cooler than Champagne. But, with most scientists estimating a 1 to 5 degree increase in climate over the next 100 years, English growers are looking forward to higher quality grapes, lower growing costs associated with less spraying to control disease, and yields that could double from a measly 1,500 bottles per hectare, or if you're an acre person, 567 bottles per acre. To put this into perspective, the best chateaus in Bordeaux, which limit their production to around 4,000 bottles per hectare, and this is considered very low, both yield and spraying costs will significantly improve economics and make winemaking a far more attractive proposition. The big change in English winemaking has been in three key areas: investment, education, and varieties of grape grown. It is the realisation that England can make and sell sparkling wines that has driven significant investment in the industry by well-funded individuals and consortiums. These include Nye Timbers' Eric Harima, who has increased his plantings from 15 hectares to 60 hectares in 2006. Other wineries have been investing heavily in planting new vines, such as Chapel Down, who are overseeing 500 hectares of new vines between 2006 and 2011. But good grapes are worthless without good winemaking, and winemakers themselves are becoming more professional. Many have been through Plumpton College's winemaking course in the last 15 years. Others are still exploring new ways of growing grapes, such as Three Choirs' attempt to grow Cabernet Sauvignon in Gloucestershire in polytunnels. Either way, the present is stable and growing, and the future is looking bright. That ends this week's Spotlight. Next week, we're going to continue our look at the future of English wine. Since we finished our poll last week, we have a new poll this week. Quite a straightforward one. Which of the following do you drink most? Is it French wine, Italian, Spanish, or Australian wines? If you recall last week, I let the results out of our monthly poll before the poll was actually finished. I think we've taken another 50 or so ratings since then, so if you'd like to find out what the final results of the poll are, you can go to our website 3050.co.uk, click on podcasts, and select wine poll, and that'll have a write-up of the last month's poll. Or, alternatively, you could subscribe to our newsletter, which is due out early next week, so you can have the newsletter delivered to your inbox. To subscribe, go to 3050.co.uk, click on Contact Us, and then fill in the details. Make sure you select newsletter in the inquiry type. The newsletter's got loads of information that we don't always cover in the shows. It also has the last four or five shows as well, and interviews. Speaking of interviews, next up we have the interview with Mariela Milanara from Catena Zapata, winery in Argentina. We talked to Mariela about the effects of altitude and winemaking. Hi, I'm here with Mariela Molinari. How are you, Mariela?
Hi, how are you, Chris?
I'm very good, very good. You're the assistant winemaker at Catena, is that right?
That's correct.
Fantastic. Catena is one of the wineries I really like. And some of your wines we do in our tastings, and they, particularly your Cabernet Sauvignon, Catena Cabernet Sauvignon, it rates in the top five consistently of all our wines that we taste with people. So it's a very popular wine.
Well, thank you.
You know, I know you guys are doing something right. But what we're going to talk about today is Catena is your vineyards are quite high in altitude, and you guys have been sort of leading the way in research into those sort of effects in Argentina. And hopefully we can talk a wee bit about them. But do you want to just give us an overview of Catena first?
Yes, well, that's correct what you're saying. Well, Nicolás Catena, Catena in general, the winery, you are talking about 3 and 4 generations making wine. And it wasn't until the third generation, which is Nicolás Catena, who made the whole change in terms of the direction where the winemaking and the winery was going. And the change basically comes when he wants to really focus on producing premium wines. He wanted to show the world that Catena in Argentina was able to produce premium wines that could be tasted and compared with any wine in the world. So in the 80s, we start to do a lot of research. As you know, in Argentina, Mendoza, it's really a desert. So most of the vineyards, most of the plantations you find in the lower side, which is pretty warm. Mm-hmm. Since we need to irrigate because it's really a desert, we don't get any rain at all. We needed to use the water that came from rivers to irrigate our vineyards. But Nicolás knew that having the advantage of the mountains that we have in Mendoza, with the second highest mountain in the world, we could go higher and get cooler temperatures, better thermal amplitudes, and because, as you well are saying, the sunshine exposure we have in Mendoza, we were going to be able to get 100% maturation of the fruit. So that's since the 1980s, all our work and all our research, trying to find higher areas, cooler areas, just to get better concentration, better maturation, and quality in our fruit.
What happens to the grapes as they get higher up the mountain?
Well, what happens is you start to get, specifically in Mendoza, you start to get cooler temperatures during the day, mm-hmm. but also cooler temperatures during the night. It's very important for a plant to not get over during the day, in the maturation time, over 31, 32 degrees Celsius, because otherwise the plant shuts down
yeah,
and the process exactly stops. But over there, the temperature never goes up that. So the plant really works nicely through the whole day. And also during the night, the temperature drops until sometimes 6 degrees Celsius. So that helps to slow down all the process of respiration so the plant kind of rests and is able to keep working the following day. So that allows us to have longer maturation time, longer hang time. That means much more concentration and production, not only of sugar, but the other components that are most important for us, which are the flavors, the aromas, and the polyphenols, of course.
They're the flavors. Flavonoids or flavors, they're just a grouping of polyphenols.
Exactly.
But there are other chemicals out of polyphenols, like your tannins.
Exactly. And the color, the tannins.
And also there's some chemicals some people relate to being quite healthy, things like resveratrol, or there's other ones, prosiodine, I think is another one.
Well, there is a pool of polyphenols that are antioxidants. Mm-hmm. One of those is resveratrol. And as you all were saying, at Catena Zapata, because we have our research and development department, we're doing lots and different experimentations in the vineyards, but also at the winery. And one of those is we're doing a lot of work with Malbec. Mm-hmm. And have found that the concentration of resveratrol, this important antioxidant, it's very, very high in our Malbecs from cool climate areas.
Oh, okay. I've read some studies that sort of said, you know, if you drink enough resveratrol, you'll live longer, but you need to, if it was in red wine terms, you know, you'd need to drink something like 1,000 litres a day of wine or something like that.
Exactly.
I did an interview with a guy called Professor Roger Corder.
Yes.
He wrote a book called The Wine Diet. He said that he's a big man, not so much in resveratrol, but more the prosiodine type chemicals and those antioxidants there. Mm-hmm. And he seemed to think that your Cabernet Sauvignon had the highest levels of proside that he had seen or recorded or measured in a wine.
Yeah, the Malbec. The Malbec was the one. Yeah, Laura Catena, who is the daughter of Nicolas, who is really a very important player at the winery. Her background is a doctor. She's a doctor, and she studied in the United States. And
medical doctor.
Yes, a medical doctor. And she has done all this research and work along with Dr. Corder. And that's true. That's what I was saying. I mean, the level of proanthocyanidins that you find in Malbec from this high-altitude vineyard, it's really huge. But as you are saying, I wouldn't recommend to drink as much as, you know...
As you can.
as you can. But I will say that a glass of Malbec every day will be good for you, for your heart and for your blood circulation.
Yeah, and your exports.
as well.
What about... some people seem to think that one of the reasons for the increase in antioxidants and all those polyphenols is maybe because as you go higher, you get more intense UV light. And that seems, some people seem to think that UV light is one of the drivers for that. Is that your experience or?
Yes, we are. That's exactly. We are now doing a research. There is a proof that, yes, it is the UV light, the sunshine exposure. The intensity of the sunshine exposure that you get in that side with the latitude where we are located at that altitude, it's really intense. The higher you go, less atmosphere and much more intensity and reaction. What is happening is that you have to imagine that when the plant is exposed to that kind of radiation, the plant needs to react. So what is happening is the plant is needs to protect the seed that is inside of the berry. So in order to protect that seed, which is the, you know, the propagation, it tends to thicken the skin. And thickening the skin, that means that you have much more cells, much more production of all these components.
Because it's tannins and color.
Which is exactly.
Comes from the skin.
All the polyphenol pool. Tannins, anthocyanins, the proanthocyanidins, and also having cooler temperatures over there, you have longer hang time, so much more time to produce and concentrate all these components.
Okay, cool temperature because you don't get your acidity dropping away, so you can leave them up on the vine. Is that is that the main driver there, or?
It's very important as well. You know, in Mendoza, it could be, as I was saying, in the lower side, quite warm. So it is a practice in some areas to add some acid to the mast when it arrives because, you know, the acid level is very low. But in these cool climate areas, one of the advantages is that we are able to preserve good acidity. Mm?
So you don't need any adjustment?
You don't need to add or adjust at all.
Because there's two things going on when a grape ripens. You've got the flavor ripeness, but you've also got the sugar acid balance changing as well.
Exactly. And the thing what is going on is, just being a little bit of technical, when the temperature drops so much during the night, what is happening is the respiration, photorespiration process. And during this process, one of the first components that the plant uses to the process is acids, or the acidity, malic acid, tartaric acid. This is why in the lower areas, this process, it's proportional to temperature. So the higher the temperature, much more rapid, or, you know, the speed of this process. But if the temperature is cool, like in these cool climate areas, the process of photorespiration is, the plant still breathe, but it slows down. So the consumption of this acid level is very, very small.
Okay.
So that's why you're able to keep and preserve the acidity.
When you first started planting up, your winemaker said that they wouldn't ripen further up the hill. I read it in one of your notes. Do you think that the UV light helps that ripening period? Because, you know, most people normally associate ripeness with temperature, but you're quite cool and you're still ripening.
Yes, that's true. Well, it was quite difficult. You have to think that it was something totally new. It was a region, you know, you're talking about 1,500 meters elevation. And Nicolas wanted to go there. He truly believed that it was possible. And his vineyard manager, the director, he said, okay, no, you're crazy. I'm not going there. You are going there alone. And the reality is that you have a combination of the sunshine exposure, but also, as I was saying, temperatures, you need temperatures, of course. And you get, in the ripening months, you get 30 degrees, 28, 29. So you get good temperatures to get to the ripening season.
Do you leave them on the vine a lot longer than maybe in the warmer areas?
Well, the thing is that all the process starts later than in the lower regions. Probably, yes, you leave 15 or a week more than in the other areas.
Well, just talk a wee bit about the wines that you guys produce, because you're doing... I think it was described in your literature as altitude blending or microclimate blending, where you're blending from different altitudes to try and increase the complexity in your wine.
Yes.
Can you just touch on that for a wee bit?
Yes. Well, all the research that we've done through all these years and still do, we have planted different vineyards, starting from 860 meters elevation up to 1,500 meters elevation. So... having all these in different microclimates, even the same clone of the same grape variety gives you totally different profiles, aromatics and concentration. So what we do, and that's what we believe, is by blending the same grape from different microclimates really gives you a completely different wine, much more complex and really a different expression.
You know, when people talk about terroir, Are you guys like hardcore soils people, or it sounds like you're quite enthusiastic towards the climate affecting the wine as well?
Well, I think we truly express our terroir. The thing is, in our terroir, temperature pattern and sunshine exposure, it's a key player there. So this is why we emphasize so much in terms of, you know, these other parameters, rather than the soil composition. The soil composition varies from one side to the other, but not as much. And given that in Mendoza, we are it's really a desert. We have no rain at all. So the drainage effect that you really get with, you know, with the soil, of course, other things as well, it's not as important as, you know, the sunshine exposure, temperature pattern, thermal amplitude, and all those other factors.
Of the wines that you make, I know your Chardonnay quite well, your Catena Chardonnay quite well, and your Malbec and your Cabernet Sauvignons, but what other wines are you producing up there?
Well, our, as you're saying, the main grape varieties is Malbec, Chardonnay, probably one of the only producers in Argentina really focusing on Chardonnay. Cabernet Sauvignon is so important, as you know, our icon wine. It's a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon and Malbec, and Nicolas is a big fan of Cabernet Sauvignon as well.
What's the name of your icon wine?
Nicolas Catena Zapata. But also, we are producing Bonarda, which is an Italian grape variety that does very well. We have very old Bonardas planted in the east side, in the lower side, and Bonarda, it's very different from the other grape varieties. All these things that I've been telling you about, cool climate, and well, with Bonarda it doesn't really work because the physiological cycle of Bonarda is quite long. So it won't ripen if you get Bonarda
too high.
So it really likes the lower side. And it's beautiful. I really recommend to try Bonarda. It's very different, but it's a great, great, great variety. And also, well, with discovering this new area at 1,500 meters elevation, we have some Sauvignon Blanc, which is doing very well, Pinot Noir. So these are the new, but few new varietals that we are working with.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I think we'll wrap it up then, Mariella. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Mariella. As many of you know, I'm not a huge soils and terroir man, other than the basics of porosity and permeability. But I think that Mariella described how the vine reacts to altitude and high UV light by thickening the grape skins as a fairly clear example of how different locations can affect the grapes. More skins give more polyphenols, including anthocyanins, the colours, tannins, and even antioxidants. Next week, we're going to be talking with New Zealander Tim Finn. And no, I'm not talking about the Crowded House singer, but Tim Finn from Nordhoff Vineyards in Nelson. Tim has been experimenting with shells to increase light exposure to his grapes. So we talk with Tim about this. And finally, before we finish up, is this week's quote from 16th century English clergyman Thomas Beacon. And he reckons, "For when wine is in, the wit is out." Personally, I think it's the other way around. When wine is in, the wit is in. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.